Hello and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Hawaii will soon have a new school superintendent. Regardless of which candidate makes the final cut, she might benefit from two recent studies. Both are from the Brookings Institution. One study considers the impact of early childhood education. The other reviews how to make teachers accountable in fair and productive ways. Contributing editor Neil Milner has had a look at the research, and he's in our studio today. Hello there.
Hi.
Looking at these studies, I mean, they're dealing with two issues that we've talked a lot about in the past, but just to have a first look at the impact of early childhood education, what does the Brookings Institution say about that?
Well, they did this on the basis of a meta study. They looked at all of the research. Some of it is good, some of it is not, and they talk about that on the effects of early childhood education. And on the basis of that, this is what they say. First of all, it's worth doing. But they have a word of caution about what that means. And they say there are two reasons we want to be cautious about saying it's worth having early childhood education, that it does have long-term and short-term positive impacts. One of which is that the difference between good programs and bad programs are so nuts and bolts, nitty-gritty. What's the curriculum like? What kind of management skills? That it's all these kinds of everyday things in the classroom and involving the principal, that it's hard to make generalizations about what a good program is.
And we've talked about this before.
Yes, we've talked about that before. How much of what works in a school and what doesn't work doesn't depend simply on changes at the political level. It depends on how the school is operating. But the second thing, which leads into our other part, is that part of the problem with saying with any kind of definitive notion that these things work is that the research is not very good. Most states, and remember, 42 states or so have universal pre-kindergarten. We don't, but we have early education programs for a lot of kids. A lot of those programs, the people don't even bother to assess them. You introduce them, you don't bother to see how they're working. And if you do, you do it in a kind of haphazard sort of way. So they say, one, we can say it's worth it. Two, it depends on a lot of stuff. And three, you really have to start looking more closely at these programs to see what works.
So what's the takeaway for a new super?
The new takeaway is this, that we should, the evidence suggests we should continue to build early education programs. We don't seem to be moving in the direction of universal pre-K. The governor here doesn't seem to be that interested in it. Go ahead, push them forward. They show good outcomes for financially deprived kids. But if you're going to do it, you have to build in a kind of assessment that monitors these programs regularly so you can actually see what's worth. You may do it one way in one school and another way in some other schools and check it out. But with something this subtle and something this important, you just have to monitor. You have to assess at all times.
So how do you narrow that down to, say, just, you know, pre-K?
Well, you probably shouldn't. In a more perfect world, you would do this. This would be generally built into policy. You and I have talked on this show before about the politics of assessment and why it doesn't happen very often. But for pre-K, one, you can start looking more closely at the outcomes of pre-K at various schools in various places here, and you can begin to look at what programs seem to work better than others. Because even in a centralized school system, there might be some differences. The other thing you can do is to allow for some kind of experimentation and comparative thing where you do a program one place in one way and another place in another, where essentially you are decentralizing, which the governor talks about all the time, but you're decentralizing to see these kinds of things. On the basis of that, you help to decide whether you want to expand the program and how you want to expand.
And you get some quantifiable data.
And you get some whatever. Yes, you get some good data. You can get good data through quantity. You can get good data through talking to people.
But, Neil, it also means additional resources going into this to make this happen.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's additional resources for under-the-radar work, and that's very hard to get. It's very hard to get people to allocate that kind of money. But it becomes very much worthwhile, and that's what that second study that we'll talk about momentarily is about.
Okay, so let's move into that one. When you're looking at how do you assess teacher performance in ways that keep them accountable in positive ways that aren't just as punitive as we've seen in past. What did this study say about that?
Well, this study comes from the little education section in the Brookings Institution called Chalkboard. And what this person did, first of all, was to look at all the different ways that occupations and professions evaluate and assess their own people. And on the basis of that, they say this about education. They say what you just said. First of all, too much of assessment has been an evaluation has been about punitiveness. And too much of it has been about concerns with digging out bad teachers and bad school scores. What the study says is if you look at the research, what you really need to do is to build a better form of assessment that leads to behavior change. So how do you do this? Well, one of the ways you do it is to make it part and parcel of everyday work. That is, it isn't just someone's going to come in, the principal's going to come in and assess me on any sort of day. If the principal comes in, the principal should come in regularly as part of the regular work. The second thing is there should be a lot of discussion about what you find. Assessment is not good just on its own. Assessment is also there so people can talk about it to help see how they change behavior. And you give incentives for changing this kind of behavior. So all of these kinds of things are assessment ways that we've known about before but haven't sufficiently applied to school systems. And I think that that's definitely true here.
One of the things that we see that's a little different this time around as we're having educational discussions is we have an HSTA that seems to be very allied with itself, that appreciates its leadership and feels that it's got some skin in the game and it's part of those around the table to be able to talk about issues of accountability, which is clearly not what has happened in past.
I think that's right. I mean, first of all, HSTA right now is made up of a bunch of the leadership. I'm not talking about the teachers. I can't generalize there. But the leadership is very smart people. The second thing that's happening through some hard fighting as well as through awareness is that there's beginning to understand that you simply can't do a punitive form of test-oriented assessment and get anywhere. So the opportunity for dialogue and mutual participation, which is, by the way enlightened labor management is supposed to operate, clearly is there now. Now, the proof of the pudding is whether it really gets carried out, because you're starting to have some hard decisions. If you do assessment the way these people in Chalkboard say you should, for example, it's time-consuming. It's hard. If you remember when we talked about that successful charter school in San Francisco, and what made it successful was the fact that the teachers put in an enormous amount of time talking to each other and changing stuff on the basis of that. It was also driving the teachers out because they had to work so hard.
But they were also given the time to do that.
Yes. But even with the time, even with a self-selected group of people and an enlightened principal, it adds more time to what's a very, very busy and awesomely consuming life for a teacher. But that's the direction you have to go. And the more you go in that direction, the more you have to think about, well, what incentives are there to move there?
So what do you think the big takeaway is for whoever or whichever candidate is successful for the superintendent position in terms of accountability and interacting with HSTA?
Well, I think the first takeaway is that every time we get a new superintendent, it's very hard for that new superintendent to break the normal bureaucratic work patterns that exist. And, of course, it's very hard for a superintendent to directly affect teaching. But I think what the superintendent has to do here is to set a tone, and let's hope that the education reform plan that's going to come out of the governor's office and this commission will do it, where it makes it possible for this dialogue to exist, where you can change the terms of assessment to what can we do to actually change people's behavior in a way that we understand works better than this old fight over test scores and over digging out the bad teachers. Whatever you think about that in terms of ideology, it doesn't work. It doesn't make the kinds of changes that people want them to make.
Neil Milner, thank you.
You're welcome.
Neil Milner taught political science at UH Manoa for 40 years. He's the contributing editor of our biweekly segment, The Long View.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, rebuilding a child's life after a separation. But first, your quiz.
Unihoa, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhawaiti.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we remember a man who spent much of his working life amid accusations that he was a crime boss, but who went to his grave without ever being charged with a crime. He was a close friend and confidant to several influential political figures, including Governor John A. Burns and his successor, George Ariyoshi. He was a former vice cop and sumo wrestler who owned and ran the state's largest private security service, a company that had security contracts at all state airports and harbors. He served as a link between Hawaii politicians and the entertainment community, and often provide entertainment for political fundraisers and at the legislature's once elaborate opening day ceremonies. For years, he was referred to in the press as the godfather of Hawaii organized crime. He was the target of investigations by the Internal Revenue Service and the Drug Enforcement Administration, and by a federal probe known by the code name Firebird. Nothing of a criminal nature was ever proven, but today we're looking for his name. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. If you're first and right, you get the prize.
Aloha, I'm Michael Clicks from Honeybee Management Services. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
They say you can't choose your family, but that's exactly what many people end up doing, making their way through life with families they've cobbled together in their search for love and security and the things that many of us take for granted. Dragonfly is a new play by Terry Madden about a young girl who loses her family and has to make her own way. The story is informed by anecdotes gathered from the foster care community during story circles and interviews. It's a Playbuilders Ensemble production. Terry's with us in our studio. Terry, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
This is powerful material for drama, isn't it?
It is, very much so. And it's from the community.
Yeah.
I think when we say Terry is the playwright, it's actually a collaborative effort with members of the foster care community.
Mm-hmm.
We have been working on it for over 2 years, and we partnered with the Foster Care Training Committee, which is comprised of members from like Catholic Charities and Foster Epic Ohana, Epic Foundation, and so forth.
But you put it together. You gave shape to stories drawn from real life.
Exactly. And with their help, I was able to meet the people that we needed to talk to. And we met once a week, Sunday evenings at the Arts at Mark's Garage.
Mm-hmm.
And at that same time, we gave acting and dance lessons to former foster youth who mm-hmm. are over the age of 18. And they and others were very generous in sharing their stories with us. And we also spoke with social workers, therapists, and resource caregivers, in particular Auntie Lean and Uncle Arthur Uesugi, who ran an emergency shelter in Waianae for many years and fostered over 300 children.
This is a community that of people who want their situation to be understood, right?
Exactly. And it actually wasn't easy to gather a lot of these stories because they're filled with pain.
Yeah.
And so the ones who shared with us, I think they did so because they wanted to help kids who are currently in foster care.
Mm-hmm.
And they want the greater community to understand their plight.
What are the important things that they want us to understand?
I think they want to they want us to understand that their journey. I can't really say what they will. I can tell you what I got from
what
it.
What came through to
okay,
you?
Okay, yeah. What came through to me is that these kids are heroes mm-hmm. because they start off in situations of neglect and abuse, and they're removed from people they love and put into homes often, you know, where they don't know. Things have gotten better mm-hmm. in the last, I would say, 6 months to 5 years. Rules and things have gotten better. But the ones that went through this years ago, they have not been able to reap those advantages. Mm-hmm. And still we won't know what the advantages will be until these kids grow up. But to me, these kids are wonderful. And I think if someone wants to become a resource caregiver, they need to understand that it's not going to be easy, but mm-hmm. it's worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. Some pretty harrowing stories in the midst of all this.
Yes. We deal with themes of sexual abuse, neglect. And
drug abuse by parents.
And drug abuse, right. And then they have to struggle with some of those issues themselves. And
In the case of things like drug abuse, alcoholism, physical abuse, patterns get repeated by children, don't they?
Right. The kids that I talked to, and I think it's because they weren't kids, they were adults, but former foster kids mm-hmm. who I spoke to, and that's why we call it Dragonfly, that they grew, that they figured things out. They had the support of the foster care system here in Hawaii. They had the support of caring individuals with great intention. But they still had their own struggles to go through. Mm-hmm. And the people that they had around them fortunately didn't give up on them. And that's what we as a community need to understand, that we can't give up on these kids. And the people I talked to, they came to a point of understanding and forgiving.
You know, Terry, what you're approaching, I think, has to do with a definition of family, in the sense of maybe family is that group of people who won't give up on you.
Right. And that's what these kids discovered, that they do have family.
Yeah.
It's just not what they were born with.
You know, in the Hawaiian tradition, I think they have a pretty healthy approach in the whole thing of the Hanai child.
Right. And it's kind of unfortunate that we have to have a foster care system at all, that we can't be more to the point where it's just person to person.
Integrated into the society.
Right.
Just a fairly normal thing.
Right.
Kids down the street lose their parents and somebody takes care of them.
Right. But it's not like that anymore.
When an institution intervenes in a child's life, suddenly you have to have a very close relationship with a stranger who's just come into your life because it was their job, right?
Right. And unfortunately, so many times they can't form those relationships. Although from the interviews I had with social workers, they try.
Yeah.
They often keep in touch with kids who are no longer on their caseload mm-hmm. and will stop by and visit and just talk to them because they care about them. And social workers are often given a bad rap.
It's an awfully tough job, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you got some testimony from them as well.
I did. And they were good. One of the stories had to do with running into a parent in Walmart. Who you had taken the child away from. You were instrumental in making sure that the family was safe mm-hmm. and having that person thank them.
Really?
For saving their children.
For taking their child away.
Right, because they were drug addicted and dangerous.
It's pretty tough. Having had that happen, it's pretty tough for parents and children to reunite, isn't it?
Right. I mean, the whole situation for a child who's removed from their home is not going to be a happy story.
Yeah.
But the fact that they persevere, they survive, they learn, and they continue to grow and mature into an adult, and that's their individual struggle.
As you shape these anecdotes into, you know, a theatrical arc, where do you want it to take the audience?
I want them to come to a point where they realize that we're all responsible for these children and that we can make the situation better for them. I would like everyone to decide to take some type of action, whether it's to take siblings out to dinner once a month to make sure that they can see their siblings, or to become a resource care provider and be willing to go through the struggles and to realize that, yes, it's hard. And the stories, so many of the stories that you hear are true about how difficult it's going to be, but that it's worth it.
No, there's no pretending it's not going to be difficult, is
right.
it, Terry? Thanks right. so much for coming in.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Terry Madden is the author of Dragonfly, a story of a young girl's journey through foster care. It's a Playbuilders Ensemble production that will be performed the weekends of May 18th and May 25th at the Arts at Mark's Garage in downtown Honolulu.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
When the Honolulu Police Commission announced it would form a citizens group to help choose the next police chief, word was the panel would include regular people. But the list of those chosen to participate is drawing criticism for representing anything but regular people. Nick Gruby from civilbeat.org has today's reality check. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Doing all right, thanks. Looking at how this whole panel came together, under the guise of regular people, seems to be a little odd given who's on it. I mean, there are people who are still trying to get their brains around the idea of Beth Chapman being on this panel. How did the idea of regular people turn up in who we see actually on this panel or not?
Right. Well, Beth Chapman, of course, is the wife of Dog the Bounty Hunter. She's a reality TV star, and I think that was a little bit surprising to most people when Max Sword, the police commission chairman, announced that she was his nominee for this selection committee. Max Sword, of course, had initially said he wanted regular people from the community to be on the selection committee to sort of bring in a community perspective. But when you look at the nominees, they're actually more of a reflection of the commissioners themselves, who are, of course, political appointees and who tend to be well-connected members of our community, whether they're high-powered attorneys, business people, state representatives, lobbyists, etc.
What I'm not hearing you say is anyone who might come from the Native Hawaiian community or any other community that might we might say, there. Look, this is really is a cross-section of our population.
Right. I think there's been a lot of criticism of the commission and some of the decisions that they made for the selection committee related to whether or not they're including the voices of individuals and stakeholders who are actually being policed by the Honolulu Police Department. This includes, of course, Native Hawaiians, who make up a disproportionate share of our prison and jail population. Micronesians, too, have high rates of interaction with the police, as do homeless individuals. And on this list, you don't see anybody representing sort of specifically those interests or those stakeholder groups.
Nick, when you look at the list, is there anybody on it that you'd look and say, well, that's a regular person? Is there even one?
Well, Luella Costellis, the police commissioner, had picked out somebody who is a, as she described, a regular person, somebody who's involved with social work and has been involved with some domestic violence issues. But of course, that individual is also a Governor David Ige appointee. Now, this is not to say that these selection committee members aren't qualified to do their job. They all have really impressive resumes, and I'm sure that they can approach the job in a way that should be satisfactory to most people. It's just whether or not their real world experiences help them in picking the right person to be our next police chief.
That seems to be the big question. So where do we go from here with this? Is there any wiggle room, or is this down and done?
Well, the police commission actually has to revisit the whole selection committee process because they didn't officially vote on it. Max Sword had said that he had he is going to reconsider Beth Chapman and whether or not he would continue to have her as a nominee on the selection committee. Of course, the commissioners are going to pick up to 5 people from the list of 13 that they have now to see who will help them grade the police chief candidates.
All right. For the moment, we're going to leave it there. But thanks very much for the reality check.
Thank you.
Nick Gruby is a reporter for CivilBeat.org. We often talk about nonprofits as 501c3s. That designation comes from the IRS code that allows tax-exempt and other status for nonprofits. Even before President Trump took office, part of that code that prohibits 501c3s from participating in candidate campaigns, the Johnson Amendment, has been in his scopes. None so much as last week with his executive order and a congressional hearing. While the law still remains unchanged, threats to it and federal funding have nonprofits focusing on advocacy. Tim Delaney is president and chief executive officer of the National Council on Nonprofits. He's in Honolulu this week for the Hawaii Alliance of Nonprofits Town Hall. Tim Delaney joins us now. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Beth. I'm delighted to be here in the land of paradise.
Well, your organization helps states focus on policy issues both at the state level and certainly at the federal levels. You have 6 areas that you've been spotlighting: spending priorities, tax reform and charitable giving incentives, healthcare reform, nonprofit independence, nonprofit nonpartisanship, and regulatory reform. That's quite a big package. But it seems at the moment that spending priorities and the threat to nonprofit nonpartisanship would be at the top of that list, are they?
Absolutely. Each of those 6 is a hot item that we are working on, again, at both the federal and the state level because they interact so much. But of those 6 right now, probably the hottest 2 are the spending priorities and then secondly, the Johnson Amendment. There are the threats there, too, that are attempting to politicize the nonprofit community.
So many nonprofits rely on federal dollars streaming through the state and winding up in their coffers. We're looking at threats to Medicaid funding, the expansion that was done under the ACA. So much of this is tied together, as you say. What particularly do you think that nonprofits really should be looking at this time around when we've had other situations where they might be threatened? But this time seems to feel different. What do you tell them this time?
The importance of coming together as a community to rally to use our voices. We cannot afford to sit on the policy sidelines anymore. We need to use our voices. We're seeing through a lot of different activity this spring, for example, on the attempt to first repeal and then replace the Affordable Care Act. The initial attempt to do that was forestalled because people were speaking up across America to say no. Similarly, I think people need to be using their voices on these proposed cuts that are not just general cuts. This would be cutting approximately 10% of the entire federal government on domestic programming, which really then hits individuals in their day-to-day lives. Most people are not aware that the extent to which the federal and state budgets are intertwined. The states, on average, receive 30.1% of all their revenue from the federal government. And so even state budgets then will be impacted if these federal cuts occur, and then local budgets will be hurt. And so everyone will be asked to do so much more for so many more with so much less. Then it will create real pain out in the community.
As you have been putting out this rallying call for nonprofits, some people might be confused when they hear nonprofits being asked to come together and to advocate on their behalf in certain ways. You're talking about an advocacy that's very different than being involved in a political campaign and sort of that nexus of what we began to talk about with the Johnson Amendment. There are a lot of people who really don't understand that part of the 501c3 code. Can you give a small primer just to make it really clear what is and isn't permissible?
Sure. Under 501c3, that is the component of the federal tax code that says that certain organizations, such as those that are charitable, religious, educational, etc., can both enjoy federal income tax exemption plus the ability to receive tax-deductible contributions, which is a very important thing. In exchange for that special status, we actually have to do three things. First, we cannot, by law, pay out any profits, hence our name, nonprofits. Second, we cannot engage in a lot of lobbying activities. No substantial part of our activities can be for lobbying. No substantial part is actually never been defined, but most organizations will never come close to the limits. The third component, which was added in 1954, says that nonprofit organizations cannot engage in partisan electioneering on behalf of or in opposition to a candidate for public office.
And that's the part that the Johnson Amendment that we have been talking about of late and that we saw targeted last week and even in February when a lot of this began to come into the public consciousness. As you look at the rallying that you've been asking of your constituents, in what way do you want them to talk about this in the practical terms that people need to understand? When you talk about having 10% of a budget that is 30% of a state budget becoming slashed?
Well, let's talk about the advocacy around the two different issues. One, the proposed budget cuts at the federal level. That's where organizations in Hawaii can be working through the Hawaii Association of Nonprofit Organizations, sometimes referred to as HANO, to lift their voices at the federal level, but also be talking to your elected federal representatives here. Also showing up on radio programs like this or letters to the editor, just using your own voice to say how harmful it would be to inform those elected officials so that they make it a wise decision. With respect to the Johnson Amendment, there are proposals to repeal it entirely as well as to substantially weaken it, and we need to let our elected officials know how painful that would be. This has worked for 60-plus years, and the attempts to just rip it away right now would politicize and weaponize nonprofits, churches, foundations, and that's not what we were created for.
For when we talk about, you know, weaponizing and politicizing, clearly that's already been done in the way we're having some of these discussions that we're seeing coming from the federal government. Those threats, at least that we've seen in Congress, haven't gone anywhere. But you're saying that, especially given this political climate, no one should rely on that or take any comfort in that because we are dealing with a very changed political climate.
Absolutely. And just look at last Thursday. There was a coordinated attack on the Johnson Amendment by the White House and by members of Congress. 55 members of Congress have co-sponsored a piece of legislation to substantially weaken the Johnson Amendment. The chair of the House Ways and Means Committee has said that he wants to put repeal into the Comprehensive Tax Reform Bill. So these are not idle threats. These are live threats to politicize us. And let me just speak for a moment on the consequences. And we'll just invite your listeners to think ahead and imagine a world in which nonprofits were partisan. And if you were all of a sudden asked to be the Republican Party YMCA or the Democratic Party YMCA, and how harmful that would be, or the Democratic Baptist Church versus the Republican Baptist Church.
And we have a historical example of what happened when we saw a church out there that I'm thinking about back into the 90s when there was the Bill Clinton full-page ad that was sponsored by a church that was asking for its political contributions.
And that is, in fact, one of the very rare instances when the IRS has actually enforced that provision of the anti-electioneering law that is known as the Johnson Amendment. And so it's rare for the IRS to actually enforce. And so to have partisans right now trying to take that limitation away and say that a subsection of the nonprofit community, just the religious groups and not charitable nonprofits or educational or others, can then engage in electioneering on behalf of or opposing to a candidate is very problematic.
I wish we had more time to talk.
Me too.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Beth Ann. And I encourage everyone to get involved in the Hawaii Association the Hawaii Alliance of Nonprofit Organizations.
Well, let me first tell everyone who you are. Tim Delaney is an attorney and policy advocate who has successfully argued in the U.S. Supreme Court, testified before Congress, and negotiated in the White House. He now heads America's largest network of nonprofits, the National Council of Nonprofits. He's in Honolulu this week for the Hawaii Alliance of Nonprofit Organizations Town Hall on Thursday.
In today's backyard quiz, we thought about a man who is routinely whispered about and sometimes characterized in the press as the godfather of organized crime in Hawaii. The charge was first leveled in the 1970s by Rick Reed, a former state senator, in a Maui newspaper, and never really went away. Hundreds of hours were spent in federal and local investigations without a successful prosecution. Investigative reporter Jim Dooley devoted a chapter to him in his memoir, Sunny Skies, Shady Characters, and was unable to say definitively that the man we're thinking of was involved in crime. I don't know the answer to that, he wrote, adding, he certainly had influence and had friends and was able to tell crime figures what to do and how to act and what not to do or how not to act. And reporter Ian Lind wrote, he was an imposing guy who demonstrated both his personal physical stature, and also his political clout. By now, you've probably guessed we're talking about the late Larry Mayhew.
Well, Wayne Gow certainly did. He called us from St. Louis Heights. Phone lines were very, very busy, but Wayne was first, and Bill will receive the prize. If you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, and you just might hear it on a future show.
Support for the backyard quiz comes from Achieve 3000. Partnering with parents and educators in Hawaii to strengthen the connection between school and home with tools to help monitor students' gains. Achieve3000.com.
On a small island, there aren't that many different opportunities for a vocal artist to be heard. and that can deprive the local audience of opportunities to hear talented singers who live close to home. It's a problem the Kauai Island Singers Showcase works to remedy with a series of themed concerts throughout the year. The latest, and a timely one it is called Celebrating Love and Mom in time for Sunday's Mother's Day. Hank Curtis is the musical director for the show, and we talked about his choice of material.
There are numerous songs about mom, as I'm sure you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the core theme for mom is to love mom, and that the theme of the show is called Love and Mom. So mm-hmm. we're combining love songs that resonate with reverence and appreciation for mom, as well as songs specifically about mom, such as the Spice Girls' Mama, or A Mother's Prayer, you know.
Uh-huh.
Songs really go straight to the core of motherly appreciation.
Sure, sure. I wouldn't have picked that Spice Girls song out, but that shows how you're casting a wide net, aren't you?
Indeed. In fact, as an arranger, I like that opportunity because I can take a song that might have been a disco hit in the 70s and transform it to some extent.
Uh-huh, sure.
Something more user-friendly.
Well, that's where the fun comes in, I would think.
That's right. That's correct.
Do you have a rotating cast of singers at the Singers Showcase?
Good question, Chris. we have a core group of probably five or six, seven people maybe that pretty much do each concert of KISS consistently since the beginning. But then we try to bring in some fresh blood. So being that I'm part of the musical community here in Kauai, I meet people and I say, gee, you've got a nice voice. Maybe you'd like to have an opportunity to perform in a concert setting, and you never know. So we have new blood every time, just about.
Have you been able to bring people into a concert setting who never thought they were going to do it before?
Well, you hit the nail on the head, Chris. That's the main reason we do this, is because there are a lot of singers and not a lot of places to perform. There's always more musicians than there are gigs. That's a golden rule of being a professional musician. But for singers especially, on a small island, you know, here on Kauai,
yeah,
we've only got Rob's Good Time Grill in a couple of karaoke bars and one or two, maybe three professional settings for vocalists, very few. So we love to give the opportunity to folks that otherwise wouldn't have it to have a live audience and to feel what that's like.
Yeah, that's kind of a shame to have so few venues. It's not that different on Oahu, of course.
Yeah, it's pretty much the same everywhere. There's a lot of people with talent that have a hard time finding a place to bring it out to the public. So we're doing our part to, you know, make that happen.
You know, and I hate to think of singers, you know, being discouraged by that, because no matter what, if you can sing and communicate with people, you need to be doing it, right?
Exactly. That's correct, yeah. And it is a small island. You know, I'm sure on Oahu there's hundreds of venues. Maybe they might not be the most auspicious venues, but there are places to perform compared to here. We're just tiny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you meet somebody who has a nice voice and had never considered, you know, getting up in front of people to use their voice, what kind of things, how do you bring them along?
Well, that comes to my position, which is as soon as I start working with a singer, the first thing we do is we try to find songs that they can own,
mm-hmm.
songs they can take ownership of, so it's really their song, so they're singing from the heart, they can relate to it, it fits their type of voice. Then we have to get into finding their keys, and then I come in as an arranger, and I take their songs, and I make them unique.
Mm-hmm.
They're not just karaoke versions. Then comes the long process of preparing, and there's a certain amount of, I think you're pointing to psychological things that help a performer, you know, step up to the plate,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, trying to coach them through performance anxiety. There's only so much I can do, but I've, you know, been there myself as a performer for
sure.
decades, so I know what it's like to get nervous, to get tongue-tied, but you don't get better at performing unless you perform.
You know, one of the things that a lot of people who are who prepare others for performance, one of the things that they say is that the audience is basically rooting for you, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. They're on your side.
They want you to succeed. Nobody wants to go see somebody fall on their face. There's not,
no, it's not UFC.
Yeah, that's not much fun.
Right. Indeed. And I think one of the things I try to convey to the singers as they are coming out to perform is that it's about the composer. We're here to represent this great work of art. So by doing that, by focusing on being a servant to the music rather than to yourself, you let go of your ego a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I think that really is important.
That's right.
And you've got some terrific composers to work with. If you are you delving into the so-called Great American Songbook a little bit?
Very much so. In fact, that probably occupies the majority of songs that we pick, just because there's just so much great stuff out there. Too many tunes, too little time is my motto.
Yeah. Well, what are some of those tunes, Hank?
Well, I'll give you an example for this upcoming concert, which is on May 13th, this coming Saturday at Kukuiula Shopping Village. And it's the first time that we're doing this in an outdoor setting, kind of like street musicians.
Yeah.
Kukuiula does a great job of employing local musicians to entertain their clientele. So this is a first. Example of some of the songs we're doing would be, you know, like I mentioned, the Spice Girls' Mama, then Celine Dion, Mother's Prayer, all the way down to Back in Time to I Only Have Eyes for You.
Oh.
Into the 20s with The Ice Swing, relatively obscure tune that was done by all the greats in the past, but not too many people know it. So picking songs is very much a big part of the whole process, because you don't want to have too many bossa novas, too many similar swing songs, too many of this, too much of that.
Yeah, too
so
many
that's
balance.
Where I come in, too, to try to design the program so that it's balanced and interesting and different tonalities, et cetera.
Well, it's you know, it adds up to a varied evening, and you're I like the idea of you performing kind of in the round is the way you are.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. We will be this coming Saturday celebrating Mom.
Hank Curtis is the musical director of the Kauai Island Singers Showcase Mother's Day Concert, celebrating love and mom during Art Walk this Saturday from 6 to 9 p.m. The KISS singers are Diana Dunville, Mike Kobayashi, Lee Miller, Eric Hagen, Melissa Mojo, Frank Nestle, Mary Ellen Kopitsky, Siri Shabad, Kamal Salibi, and Trudy Vella. And it's at the shops at Kukuiula in Poipu. It's free, and you can get details on the Conversations Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from Honolulu Waldorf School on Oahu and Haleakala Waldorf School on Maui, serving Hawaii's families from infancy with parent-child programs through high school, now accepting applications at both schools.
It's time to check in on the varied palette of activities going on around the state with Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama, who joins us for a look at events going on under the radar. Today, we've got a lot of interest lately in South Korea without quite knowing what's been going on there, haven't we?
Yes. South Korea has just elected a new president, and there's a lecture tomorrow about the country's social changes in the past 50 years. Hagen Koo is a sociology professor at UH Manoa, and he's been studying and writing about how South Korea has transformed itself from a poor agricultural country to a highly industrialized and globalized society. And he'll reflect on theories that have influenced his research. I guess he's about to retire. This is happening at 4 p.m. tomorrow in the Center for Korean Studies Auditorium at UH Manoa.
And then we have another UH event talking about the benefits of aging. Evidently, there are some.
Yes, there are. Dr. Virginia Hinshaw, Chancellor Emeritus and Professor of Tropical Medicine at UH Manoa, presents a discussion on the benefits of aging and living a healthy, vital life. She'll answer questions such as, what are the benefits of aging? What can we do as individuals to ensure that we maximize our benefits? How can we handle the major transitions as we age? It's Friday at East O'ahu Realty. That's next to Roy's Restaurant in Hawaii Kai from 12:30 to 2. It's free, and there's a free light lunch being served as well.
So there are benefits to aging, and there's a free lunch.
On top of that, yes.
Two things I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And on Friday, there's a free vocal concert in Hilo.
The ensemble Voices is led by local voice teacher Mark Sheffield. The group's pianist is Kanako Okita, and they will bring their unique interpretations of classics and new favorites to the First United Protestant Church in Hilo. It's on Friday at 7:30. Admission is free, but a donation is suggested. And there's also a show on Saturday at 7:30.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. And you can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today for the conversation. Up tomorrow, is the stigma of mental illness really fading? We're going to talk about it. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. We hope you'll plan to join us tomorrow for Town Square.
And we'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line. Leave us your comments at this phone number, 808-792-8217. If you'd like to email us, that's talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR.
And if you missed this of any of the show, or you want to hear something again, you can either do that at 7 p.m. tonight, or you can find out more on The Conversation page. It's got links to more information about guests and topics, and you can hear it again by looking under The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you tomorrow for Town Square.